Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.immc.org, for May 24th to the 30th, 2014. While rival Palestinian groups, Fatah and Hamas, are set to announce the first national consensus cabinet following reconciliation, this week Israeli attacks leave a Palestinian old man dead. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report as usual with the nonviolent activities organized in the West Bank. This week, three protesters were injured when Israeli soldiers attacked nonviolent protests organized in West Bank villages. IMEMC's Iman Abdrabbo Bannoura with the details.
Protests were organized on Friday in the village of Annabi Saleh, Bil'in Na'lin, Central West Bank, and Al-Masara village in Southern West Bank. In Bil'in al-Na'lin, Israeli soldiers attacked the protesters as soon as they reached the gate of the wall that separates local farmers from their lands. Troops stationed at the wall fired tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets at the protesters in Bil'in al-Na'lin. Three civilians were lightly wounded in Bil'in village by the army attack. Moreover, many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation in both villages. At the nearby village of Annabi Saleh, soldiers stopped the protest before leaving the village. Later, soldiers stormed the village and fired tear gas into residents' homes, causing damage. Meanwhile, Israeli troops attacked the villagers of Al-Masara and their supporters at village entrance, then forced them back using rifle butts and batons. No injuries were reported. For IMEMC News, this is Iman Abdrabbo Bannoura.
Following resounding victory of Egypt's strongman and ex-army chief, Abd al-Fattah al-Sisi, during latest Egyptian elections, Palestinians express the hope that borders with Egypt will be reopened normally. Meanwhile, major Palestinian parties, Fatah and Hamas, are set to announce the first national consensus cabinet following reconciliation. IMEMC's Ram al-Mighari has the story.
Palestinian official bodies and representatives of civil society organizations welcomed this week results of latest presidential elections in Egypt. They expressed the hope that the newly elected Egypt's strongman and ex-army chief, Abd al-Fattah al-Sisi, will allow a normal movement between Gaza and Egypt. Last July, al-Sisi ousted the first elected Egyptian president, Islamist Mohamed Morsi, under massive pressure and widespread protests against Morsi. Since the ouster, Rafah Crossing Terminal, sole outlet for Palestinians to the outside world, has remained rather closed, leaving thousands of Gaza travelers stuck inside the coastal occupied territory. In the meantime, the Islamist ruling Hamas party in Gaza believed that an announcement of a national consensus technocrat government will be delayed for days. Hamas's spokesperson in Gaza, Sami Abu Zuhri, wrote on his official Facebook page, "Cancelling the prisoners' portfolio contradicts our Palestinian national interests." Hamas had objected to President Mahmoud Abbas's intention to assign veteran foreign minister with the current Ramallah-based government, Riyad al-Malki, with the same post in the new cabinet. Hamas wants a new name to take the post, Ziyad Abu Amr. Last week, both Hamas and Fatah representatives agreed on 15 different portfolios within the National Reconciliation Pact, reached last month. Fatah of the Western-backed President Mahmoud Abbas and the internationally boycotted Islamist Hamas ended 7 years of political split. In a related news, Palestinian-Israeli peace negotiations have been held off since both Hamas and Fatah have reached the reconciliation deal. Israel insists that Hamas should outright recognize Israel before any talks are resumed. For IMEMC News, I am Rani Al-Mighari in Gaza.
This week, an elderly Palestinian man died due to tear gas inhalation. Meanwhile, the Israeli army forces conducted at least 65 military invasions targeting Palestinian communities in the West Bank and Gaza. During these attacks, Israeli troops kidnapped at least 46 Palestinians, including 10 children. IMEMC's Anna Franzowicz reports.
An elderly Palestinian physician died on Tuesday due to the effects of tear gas inhalation. He was hurt and hospitalized several days ago. Local sources said that Dr. Sami Abu Ohesh, 64, from Abu Dis, Palestinian town southeast of occupied Jerusalem, was hospitalized in a critical condition after inhaling tear gas from a tear gas canister that was fired by Israeli soldiers invading the town on Sunday. Dr. Sami held senior positions at the Palestinian Ministry of Health, the Jericho Hospital Administration, and also ran a clinic as well as a pharmacy in Abu Dis. Palestinian youth was severely injured on Thursday after being ran over by an Israeli army military vehicle in the village of Beit Umar north of Hebron, according to a local activist. 15-year-old Anan Abu Ayesh suffered severe head injuries after being run over by an Israeli army jeep. He was also transferred to a hospital for medical treatment. On Wednesday, three civilians were injured by Israeli forces after they violently dispersed a public protest organized by Palestinians in Jerusalem's Old City. Palestinians gathered in protest because of Israel's Jerusalem Day celebration, a day that for Palestinians marks the Israeli occupation of East Jerusalem since 1967. Also this week, a hunger-striking Palestinian political detainee, Abed Thweb, 44, who is held by Israel, was moved to an Israeli hospital after he suffered a heart attack on Thursday. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Ministry for Political Prisoner Affairs announced that 80 hunger striker detainees have been moved to hospitals by the Israeli army due to the deterioration in their health. More than 200 detainees started their strike on April 24, 2014, in protest of Israel's administrative detention and ill-treatment by their captives. Israel uses the administrative detention to hold Palestinians for longer periods of time without charges or being shown in court in front of a judge. In the Gaza Strip on Wednesday, Israeli Navy forces abducted early in the morning three fishermen working off the Rafah coast in the southern Gaza Strip. Additionally, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation has released a report stating that the life in the Gaza Strip has become unbearable due to the imposed siege and the closure of crossings. For IMEMC News, this is Anna Friends.
And that's all for today from This Week in Palestine. This was the weekly report for May 24th to the 30th, 2014, from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This week's report has been brought to you by George Shumawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly show hosted for many years by Sharif Fahm and continued in his loving memory by a group of his dedicated friends. Every week, This Week in Palestine brings you news and views from a distinctly Palestinian perspective, a perspective seldom heard in the United States. On this week's show, we'll feature an interview of Rashid Khalidi on From Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Now, this interview is from a few months ago, but it contains a valuable perspective and analysis. And now, Building Bridges featuring Rashid Khalidi.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Professor Rashid Khalidi author of 6 books about the Middle East. His latest publication, Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East, and the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University, draws on his experience as a Palestinian negotiator and his first-hand understanding of the Arab-Israeli peace talks as brokered by Washington to unpackage the latest endeavor and discuss the difficult but essential steps needed to achieve peace in the region.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And I want to begin with your book, apropos of where we are right now, Mr. Kerry, just having left the process of negotiations in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. How would you describe the role of Secretary of State John Kerry in this latest round of negotiations?
Well, I don't think that the Secretary of State, for all of his efforts, has changed U.S. policy in any of its essentials. The United States still subscribes entirely to the Israeli narrative, which is that there is a conflict, not that there is one party that is victimizing and oppressing another. And another aspect of that narrative is that the United States has operated as an honest broker, fairly trying to adjudicate between the two sides. And as I argue in my book, that is not and has really never been the case. The United States essentially subscribes to a whole range of Israeli positions and has worked very hard to force the Palestinians into accepting those positions.
In this most latest attempt, was there anything at all achieved? I know that Kerry's plane was hardly up in the air when the Israelis announced a new wave of settlements, I believe 1,400 units.
Right. We're being kept in the dark because one of the aspects of this is that they've asked that the parties not leak. They have been leaking a little bit. Among the things we do know is that the Secretary of State has scaled down his aspirations from a full-blown agreement to what is now being called a framework, and that he is focused very largely in the first phase on the Israeli demands around security. What we have heard, and this may or may not be correct, is that the United States has either accepted or is transmitting an Israeli demand that Israel maintain control over all borders and the Jordan River Valley in particular for a period of as much as 15 years. It's not clear how long. This essentially means we're not talking about a Palestinian state, perhaps ever, probably ever, but certainly not for the foreseeable future, because apparently the end of that period during which Israel would continue essentially to occupy and control the territories is up to Israel. In other words, the Israelis can decide if the Palestinians have jumped through enough hoops such that they can end their occupation, which means that essentially this is a non-starter. Whether the parties will accept this is anybody's guess, or whether in fact these are the real outlines. Again, we're not entirely sure.
Just to pursue a little bit more about one area, like the Jordan Valley, which has been described as the breadbasket for a future Palestinian state. And so the water issue and the land issue is critical.
Right.
And there seems to be a definitive insistence that there be, well, I want you to get into it, but Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel insists on maintaining that long-term Israeli military presence along the border. So is this a complete vitiation of any possibility of, assuming one accepts the two-state solution, of a Palestinian state?
If Israel continues to control security and has all the real attributes of sovereignty, there is not a two-state solution. There's a one-state solution, or a one-state, one Bantustan, or a one-state, one puppet state, or you can call it whatever you want. This is the framework for a one-state solution. This is what we have now. This is what we've had since 1967 when Israel occupied the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, and other territories, the Golan Heights and the Sinai Peninsula. Israel is the only state between the river and the sea, and would continue to be the only sovereign state between the river and the sea. Whatever they call this made-up entity, it would not be a state, it would not be sovereign, it would not be independent, it would not exercise self-determination. It's a farce. I mean, one of the things I argue in my book is that what we're seeing is Orwellian language, a peace process, two-state solution. These terms are not being used honestly. There is not a two-state solution on offer if Israel is going to control the Jordan River Valley and entry and exit into the occupied territories indefinitely. Today, every resident of the territories has to be vetted by Israel. You cannot enter. You cannot visit. You cannot register your child. You cannot marry. You cannot do anything without the approval of the Israeli authorities. Israel is the only sovereign power. There is one state. And under this formula, as far as we understand it, that would continue to be the case. So there is not now and will not be for the foreseeable future, if this is in fact Kerry's plan, a two-state solution.
And of course, if we just break that down further, if you look at the northern Jordan Valley area, presumably people literally, they get running water once every 3 days,
exactly,
which they are forced to store in cisterns and bottles. And this is in towns in the West Bank like Bardala and so on. So
exactly,
it's even more pointed and poignant in its restriction and reaction.
You put your finger on something that's crucial. The West Bank sits over the main aquifer in historic Palestine. And one of the reasons that Israel intends to keep control, or is going to try and keep control permanently, is to control that water. Right now, not only do the residents of the Jordan River Valley suffer draconian restrictions on water, so, by the way, do the residents of Gaza. They suffer in terrible water shortages. But all residents of the West Bank use a fraction, or allowed, I should say, by Israel, which controls the water, to use a tiny fraction of the water that is allotted per capita to the settlers, the 600,000 or so Israelis living illegally in colonies all over the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and who have unlimited water supplies drawn from these same aquifers. So one of the features of the demands that Israel has put forward is not only that it control population movement and goods and all economic activity through its control of entry and exit, but also that it continue to control the water resources.
Another demand that Netanyahu has made, and this is new to me, it's probably not new to you, is, and it sort of puts the onus on the Palestinians as being the bad guys, is that the Palestinians agree that the state of Israel be a Jewish homeland.
Well,
what's going on here?
Yeah, this is a new demand made up very recently by Israeli officialdom. It's what's called an impossible demand. What would make the other side refuse? Well, let's demand something that they cannot possibly accept. What this means is that the Palestinians have to essentially say, this is not our country, this is your country, this is your homeland. Israel doesn't limit its understanding of Israel to the 67 borders. As far as Israel is concerned, on any Israeli government map, Israel is the entire territory. Whatever autonomy or other illusory levels of freedom from control they allow the Palestinians in parts of that. And for the Palestinians to say this would involve negating their own national narrative and, in effect, becoming Zionists, saying, we accept that you are the only people with real rights here in the only area of our historic homeland, which the Palestinians see all of Palestine as their historic homeland. If the Israelis feel that it's their historical homeland, nobody can tell them that that's not the way they feel. If they were to say, we declare it's this or we declare it's that, nobody's able to do anything about that. What they're insisting, uniquely in the history of international law, is that one party accept another party's definition of itself. It's really quite remarkable. Israel never demanded this of Egypt or Jordan as part of their signing a peace treaty with Israel. Rabin never demanded this of Yasser Arafat when he signed the Oslo Accords on the White House lawn. This is a brand new, impossible demand inserted in order to guarantee that there not be a settlement, because Netanyahu's preferred outcome is just a continuation of the status quo. Israel has played for time, really since 1967, hoping that the Arabs would come around and accept whatever crumbs they were thrown or offered. And I think that is his preferred outcome here, too.
It's quite interesting, since more recently there have been some articles about the Africans who have continued to protest in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
The society, which now has thousands of Africans, asylum seekers, who have flooded into Tel Aviv and so on. I was just thinking about that in relationship to the Israeli demand of a Jewish state, which somebody actually, I think it was Juan Cole, who said that it's analogous to the U.S. talking about a white state, although one would argue that indeed the U.S. is based on white supremacy. But that's for another discussion.
Though it's increasingly demographically turning into a mixed race state. Before our very eyes.
Yes, indeed, which is, of course, part of what the real fight is about here as well. But, you know, one of the things that I want to go back to is the issue of the U.S. as honest broker,
mm-hmm.
Notwithstanding the immediacy of Kerry's intervention. But how do you sum it up? What is, how you understand it, the role of the U.S. in this contextual situation? What sits It's objective. What has it really done to, if anything, capitulate almost in its entirety now to the most aggressive and intransigent demands of Netanyahu, of the Israeli state?
Of the most right-wing government in Israel's history, as it happens. One of the things I do in the book is I crib from, of all people, Henry Kissinger, who described what Israel really wanted of the United States as the United States serve as Israel's lawyer. And I quote Aaron David Miller, quoting Kissinger, saying, this is really what we have become. We have become Israel's lawyer. We are not an honest broker. Miller speaking as an American State Department official. We have become essentially shills for the Israelis, acting on their behalf, putting forward their positions. That's what essentially President Clinton did in the 2000 Camp David summit. It was Clinton who put forward the plan that Barack never gave him on paper, but outlined for him. The United States, in effect, became not an honest broker, but a broker for Israel, or a lawyer for Israel. And I think that you can see the difference between the American position where the Palestine issue is concerned and the U.S. position on issues where American national security or major national interests are concerned, where the United States has shown a willingness to not just not do what Israel wants, but go very much against Israeli wishes. This goes back to the early phases of the Cold War in the Middle East, when President Eisenhower forced Israel out of the Gaza Strip and the Sinai Peninsula, because at the time it was very important to the United States in the Cold War context to highlight Soviet aggression in Hungary. Similarly, much more recently, in the late 60s and the 70s, the United States bullied Israel into accepting a whole series of accords, the Rogers Plan in 1969-70, the interim accords of the mid-1970s. I would argue the peace treaty with Egypt. Begin had to be bullied into that, essentially, by President Carter, because this gave the United States enormous advantage in the Cold War, or because this diffused a crisis in American-Soviet relations. In those instances where vital interests were seen as being on the line, American presidents and American diplomats have been ruthless in compelling Israel to do what the United States wanted. And I think we've seen something similar in the way the United States has completely ignored the Israeli position to the extent to which it's been able to in the last years of the Bush administration and during both of Obama's terms, where the issue of Iran has been concerned. Israel very much wanted to either bomb Iran, get the wherewithal from the United States to bomb or otherwise attack Iran, and then get the United States to finish the job for it. It's very, very clear that this one Netanyahu and all his supporters in Congress were pushing for. President Bush, in his second term, finally came around to understanding that a third American land war in Asia on his watch might look bad. And he was essentially convinced by his military intelligence and other advisors that he should not go along with Netanyahu and Vice President Cheney. And he turned the Israelis down. President Obama has done the same thing. He's done the same thing on Syria, ignoring advice from the hawks, the Israel lobby, and the Israelis to attack Syria and essentially, again, involve the United States in yet another major land war in Asia.
Rashid Khalidi, we wanted to also, I mean, this clearly is a ticking time bomb in so many ways for the Palestinians, the expansion of the settlements, which continues unabated and indeed is aggressive, the wall, which is not a construction, but I think it's been described as an annexation, really, of territory.
I think that's a very good description, yes.
So from the Palestinian perspective, what absolutely must be recognized, and then is there any hope that you have at this juncture that the Palestinians can force the world, the U.S., to offer support for their demands for self-determination?
By mentioning self-determination, you put your finger on what has to be the most important demand, something the United States has never really fully supported. The Palestinians have a right, an absolute inalienable right, to live independently as a people in their own land, free of foreign control. It's a basic right, now recognized in the UN Charter. It's something the United States was established on the basis of, the idea that people in North America not be ruled by parliament and by the king. It's something that the Palestinians have been denied throughout their modern history. They have been ruled by others, whether the British or whether Jordan or Egypt or whether Israel, through the entirety of the 20th and 21st centuries. And that is an absolute bedrock thing, which the United States has never really supported. The fact that Kerry is talking about another 15 years of Israeli tutelage of control over, a domination over the Palestinians, means that we're not there. We're nowhere near there. So that's the first thing. The second thing is equality. Equality and rights. What is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. The Israelis are not a special people. The Israelis are people. They have rights. They have a right to security. But there's no reason that an Israeli child should have more of a right to security than a Palestinian child, or that an Israeli should have more security than a Palestinian, or any other rights that a Palestinian not have. And that has not been a feature of any of the solutions that have been put forward to this day. Many people now question whether it is possible even to have a two-state solution should the United States come around to a more equitable position, given the degree to which Israel has annexed and absorbed the occupied territories. If that is possible, the question still remains, how do you have fully equal rights for all individuals of both peoples within this land? And I think that really is going to involve a whole lot of changes in attitudes, in particular in Israel. It will involve changes on the part of all sides, but in particular will involve a change in Israel, which sees itself as the eternal victim, sees itself as entitled to special treatment, and simply refuses to extend to others the things that it arrogates to itself. And you're going to have to change attitudes in this country for that transformation to take place as well.
And just lastly, mostly because of, if nothing else, the three-page spread from the front page to the inner pages of the New York Times and every other place, the accolades with some just...
Or Sharon, you mean, yes.
Yes. Comment?
Yes. This is the apotheosis. I have a piece going on foreignpolicy.com, I hope, this evening. This is the apotheosis of a war criminal into a god. The American media has been whitewashing this man systematically ever since he passed away in the most disgraceful fashion. I've done interviews with Irish, Chinese, British media, and they don't treat this man with kid gloves. They talk about him as a war criminal. They feature all of the atrocities and horrors for which he was responsible. Only in this country do you have this kind of ridiculous hagiography replacing honest reporting. It is truly disgraceful. This is a man who should have ended his career before the International Criminal Court in The Hague. As I say, being lauded by our vice president and other Americans in a truly disgraceful fashion.
Well, I want to strongly recommend that Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East by Rashid Khalidi be something that is on your reading list. It is an extremely important book, and I hope we can count you on one of our regular commentators to discuss what is critically important in the world community, and certainly the very survival and issue of the Palestinian people is something that we consider of the utmost importance. And
I'd
really want
to
thank you. Well, we again have been speaking to Rashid Khalidi, author of many books, again, The Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now, in a recent talk, Rashid Khalidi introduced his book, Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East.
Thank you for coming. I'm going to be talking about why there is no peace. Most of what I will be talking about will be drawn from my own experiences and from my research and from the book, Brokers of Deceit. As we all know, the Secretary of State has been traveling around the Middle East, engaged in mediating renewed negotiations between the PLO and Israel. And there have been very low expectations on all sides. Usually the media give us the reasons why there's not a lot of optimism about these talks. The first is the weakness of the PLO and of the Palestinian Authority headed by Mahmoud Abbas, which is related to deep-seated and corrosive and destructive and entirely stupid divisions among Palestinians, divisions that are considered reprehensible by the overwhelming majority of Palestinians. The second is the uncompromising pro-settlement orientation of the current Israeli coalition government headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, by far the most right-wing, pro-settler, least compromising government in Israel's history, and that is saying a lot in every one of those categories. And so these are all good reasons why this may well not work. I would suggest there are other, deeper reasons to look skeptically at the process. I'm a historian, so I'm going to argue that it is actually necessary to go back and examine some of the structural reasons why, in decades, the United States has not succeeded in bringing about a settlement between Israel and the Palestinians. Going back, at the very least, to the Madrid Peace Conference, which took place in October-November of 1991, or going back to Camp David in 1978. And I'm going to start by taking us back to 1991. In the preparations for that Madrid peace conference, Secretary of State Baker sent letters of assurances to all the parties, one to Israel, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and one to the Palestinians. The letter to the Palestinians responded to some of the pressing concerns they had expressed to the Secretary of State over many months of negotiations. And he responded to these concerns in this letter of assurances by promising that the United States would oppose actions which were described as prejudicial or precedential to negotiations. In other words, the United States would oppose anything that would prejudice the negotiations that were about to begin or that would establish unfortunate precedents which would harm the negotiations, such as Israeli settlement activity. In other words, back in 91, the U.S. Secretary of State was making a commitment to the Palestinians that this was something that was bad for negotiations and the United States would oppose it. This was only one of several unkept American commitments to the Palestinians. The letter also said, and I quote, "The United States will act as an honest broker." Two administrations later, under President George W. Bush, during a subsequent stage of U.S. brokered Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, then Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in 2008 told a Palestinian delegation, she wanted to, I quote now, "I want to tell you what I think of your positions without hurting my role as an honest broker." So you see this term recurring over decade after decade after decade. This 1991 commitment, unkept commitment, I would add, and what Secretary Rice said in 2008 are reiterations of a central myth about this conflict. This myth is that the United States serves as an honest broker between these two parties. In this book, I try to show that far from acting in such a fashion, for decades, the United States has behaved in a thoroughly one-sided way. In consequence, I'm cutting to the chase here, far from resolving this conflict, the United States has made it worse. That is what has happened at every phase of this conflict since the 1970s, and I would argue it's likely to do the same in this current iteration. There are many, many, many myths about this conflict. According to another myth, this is a conflict between near equals. We have the Israelis, we have the Palestinians. The Palestinians have their authority, the Israelis have their state. According to this myth, these are equal parties in which one of them is not a victimizer and one of them is not a victim. In fact, according to this myth, if there is any victim, it is Israel. In fact, in the American media, Israel is systematically portrayed as being victimized by Palestinian terrorism, Palestinian aggression. This is not the reality. Anybody who's even been there and who have actually bothered to spend some time on both sides knows that this is a highly asymmetrical conflict. It is not a conflict between equals. It is a conflict between a powerful state that's been there for 65 years and which is fully supported by the greatest power in world history. That's this country. On the other side, there is a divided Palestinian people, a large part of which has been living under occupation for 46 years, a people that has never in its entire history enjoyed self-determination or statehood, and have lived for their entire modern existence either under alien rule or dispersed in exile from their homeland. That's the reality, and how that reality can be transmuted into a conflict between equals, each with its own entity and in negotiations that are supposedly equal, is actually beyond me. I argue in the book that you have to go to language to understand how these myths can be created. Language has had an enormous importance in their construction. I quote George Orwell, who in 1946 wrote, I'm now reading from Orwell's essay on the English language, "The slovenliness of our language makes it easier for us to have foolish thoughts. If thought corrupts language, language can also corrupt thought. Dishonest, corrupt language ruins our thinking." The framing of this conflict using fundamentally dishonest terms like honest broker or peace process. They've been doing this for 35 years. Have they produced peace? No. Use of these kinds of terms to describe what is actually happening has masked a reality of continuing complicity of a series of U.S. administrations in the continued dominance of the Israeli state over the Palestinians. This has made the prospects of a settlement less likely. The United States has not helped to resolve this conflict. The United States has made this conflict infinitely worse. The distortion of language has made a big contribution to this process by corrupting thought and cloaking the real nature of the outcome. The complicity between these two countries on this issue is not just a matter of domestic politics or the ideas or wishes of this president or that president or the other. We have illusions about our government system. We think that each person who comes into power is completely free to do whatever he or one day she wants. That's not true. When the Sultan puts on his robes, when the emperor takes up his scepter, when the president steps into the Oval Office and becomes commander-in-chief, when that individual takes on that authority, that individual is changed by that office. Especially enormous power, imperial power, global power, a Sultan or an emperor or a U.S. president. In the case of the United States and Israel, the specific complicity between them is not just a matter of this president's whims or that president's desires. It's grounded in a secret letter that was sent by President Ford to then Prime Minister Rabin about negotiations involving the Palestinians. And in this letter, the U.S. president said that the United States would, quote, coordinate with Israel with a view to refraining from putting forth proposals that Israel would consider unsatisfactory. This commitment is still binding to this day. The United States has trampled all over every commitment that I know it has ever made to the Palestinians. It has never been faithful to any commitment that I'm aware of to the Palestinians. There weren't that many, by the way. But this is a commitment the United States has faithfully kept. In other words, this letter says the United States cannot propose anything of which Israel does not approve on this issue. There are other issues on which the United States has felt free to make propositions that Israel has disapproved of mightily. This is the basis of the idea that is embraced by politicians from one end of the political spectrum to the other, Vice President Biden to Senator McCain, that there should be, quote, no daylight between the American and the Israeli positions, or put differently, that there is a no surprises doctrine between the two countries. This closeness between the United States and Israel, and indeed the identity of their positions, in effect, explains why the United States really hasn't been an honest broker. In the book, I touch on what I think are three moments of clarity in the history of U.S. policy on the Palestine question. I go back to Truman, in fact. I talk about this 1975 letter. I talk about many things, but I focus on three moments. The first was starting with the Camp David agreements and peaking in the summer of 1982 when the United States decided to put forward the Reagan plan. The second moment had to do with the negotiations that started in Madrid in October of 1991 and continued through the end of those negotiations in 93, the negotiations I was a part of, and then were in effect further continued through the Oslo negotiations that produced the awful agreements that the Palestinians suffer under today. The third moment, the first term of President Obama. If this history tells us anything, it's that the process the Secretary of State is engaged in cannot produce such an outcome. It can only extend into the future the entirely unsatisfactory status quo. Thank you.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
And this concludes another edition of This Week in Palestine, which is a weekly segment on WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, that is a part of Truth and Justice Radio, which airs every Sunday from 6 to 10 a.m. We hope you will join us again for news and views from and about Palestine.